This morning, we look at the year on Broadway, 2018, and it was quite a year. Movie properties were plentiful. Mean Girls, Pretty Woman, Frozen, and even King Kong. The ever-persistent jukebox musical form came from the songs of Cher, Donna Summer, and the Go-Go's. There was lots of star power. Kerry Washington, Bryan Cranston, Chris Evans, Laurie Metcalf, Andrew Garfield, Armie Hammer, and Elaine May, just to name a few. And there were amazing transfers from London that landed on Broadway and have made an impact. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, the National Theater productions of Network and Angels in America, as well as the Jez Butterworth powerhouse, The Ferryman. There is nobody better to discuss the year on Broadway with than Ben Brantley. Ben has been the co-chief theater critic of the New York Times since 1996, filing reviews regularly from London as well as from New York, and we are thrilled to welcome him to our studio this morning. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Very nice to have you here to talk Broadway. So before we get into the nitty-gritty, overall, what kind of year do you think it was?
You know, when I went back and reflected, when you're in the midst of it, there are moments when you think, oh, no, we're sort of down in the depths, aren't we? But we weren't. When you look back, it was actually a very interesting year, both in terms of the big, opulent Broadway productions, but also in terms of sort of corner in the hole places you wouldn't expect to visit, just some terrific plays by young talents that I think had new things to say in new ways as well.
When it comes to Broadway specifically, what kind of new talents did you see emerge?
Well, new talents on Broadway, that's kind of an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Not so much, I don't think. Jez Butterworth, I mean, that for me was the production of the year, The Ferryman, with this incredible, expansive 3.5-hour production with 21 speaking parts set in Ireland during the Troubles, early 1980s. But every character just so individually drawn in a sense of the larger sort of social context closing in on you. Jez Butterworth is not new to Broadway. He did Jerusalem with Mark Rylance, which was splendid, one of my favorite plays of since I've been in this job. Otherwise, on Broadway, well, we did see the novelty of a very, very big actor making his debut, King Kong, a two-ton actor, as a matter of fact, which is not a great production, but the puppet is kind of amazing to look at.
You did a co-review with
Jesse Green.
Green on that show, and I did see that. It is that's a spectacle, right? That's a way of showing off, I guess, what Broadway can do.
It is. I mean, or what Australia can do, which is
yes.
is where it hails from. I mean, I don't think it's enough to have something really big, no matter how mobile, in the center of the stage. I think you have to surround it with more provocative or at least interesting or at least entertaining material than this show managed to provide. But yeah, can't help loving that ape.
I don't remember a note.
No, you don't. No, it was a pretty generic score. I can't even remember the name of the composer. Isn't that awful? But I think initially it wasn't a musical, or was it? It's gone through so many transformations since it began. Began in Australia, different book writers and so forth. This one didn't really track for me. The dancing was repetitive, but enough bashing King Kong. As I said, it's a great ape that's on that stage.
You mentioned Ferryman a moment ago, and that is 3.5 hours of just stunning theater, beautifully acted, dramatic theater. My goodness, I even enjoyed the children.
Exactly. And how you get, of course, these are a special kind of children, foul-mouthed for one thing.
Yeah.
But oh gosh, every single person in it, you're right. 21 speaking parts, including older people with very strong memories of the Ireland that was and very fierce resentments that date back to the Sunday Rebellion, to the Easter Rebellion, and then all the way to a literal baby in arms who behaved very well the night I saw him. I think that's always kind of a... a crapshoot when you bring an infant onto the stage. But yes, it was the second time I'd seen it. I'd seen it when it opened in London at the Royal Court Theatre before it transferred to the West End. And seeing it the second time, I was so impressed by how everything cohered. I mean, the first time I saw it, I was just sort of swept up by the excitement, by the momentum of what is really winds up being a very suspenseful plot. But this time around, every image seemed to click into place. I have tremendous respect for Jez Butterworth.
I promised I wouldn't do this. I made this promise to myself in talking to you and getting off the subject and asking about some of your rules and things that you do in as far as reviewing. But does it interest you when a show transfers, Angels in America, Network, Ferryman,
right,
all transfers from London, how they land here?
Oh, of course. I think what the performers would tell you, although some of these were slightly recast, not Ferryman, which came with its original cast, but I think performers will tell you who've appeared in London and then in New York that an audience always defines a production so much. We're such participants in making, in the energy of that particular production. Where I noticed a real difference was a play called The Jungle, which is an immersive experience in which the camp at Calais, where the immigrants were a couple of years ago, of all different nations in France, is recreated with specific characters in a storyline, but it's very much sort of like being there. And when I saw it in London, everyone in the house was in floods of tears. In New York, they were dry eyes. I think people were impressed and were moved, but it wasn't our immigration problem. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
If it had been set at the border where the wall is supposed to go up, that might have been something different. But it seemed a little, I don't know. I mean, usually you think of the British as being so much more reticent emotionally. And it was strange to see so many dry-eyed Americans at what for me was a very emotional, very involving show.
What does it say about London, particularly National Theatre, looking at both Angels in America and Network, of starting in London and then bringing them to the States?
Well, especially since both have very American roots.
Right.
Angels in America, of course, is the great American play of the past 50 years, probably, or 30 years anyway, by Tony Kushner. And this revival, well, actually, Angels in America had been done the first time at the National Theater before, or at least the first part, before it opened in New York. So there's form for that, as they say. And Network, of course, is based on an American film and stars a really incredible Bryan Cranston as the news anchor who is mad as hell and has at least four or five nervous breakdowns on stage before our very eyes. I mean, there was a time when plays of dubious American plays and playwrights whose reputations had faded in the States, who seemed to be underappreciated, would go to London, or in spirit at least, to be resuscitated, to be rejuvenated. Tennessee Williams plays like Orpheus Descending with Vanessa Redgrave years ago, but that was a play no one had really thought about so much in the States. So I do think there's some of that. Arthur Miller, I think, is for a long time was more honored in London. I mean, when we tend to be a little more fashion conscious, I think, and things do fall out of fashion in New York. The Brits, I think, adore seeing playwrights that we've sort of forgotten about as prophets without honor in their own land and bringing them back to life. In this case, it was just Marion Elliott, who directed Angels in America, brought a very particular vision to it, which made it different without really altering the incredible moral substance of it. And it had a spectacular cast. But again, between London and New York, a fair amount. But it's harder to make the distinction in many cases, especially the large scale, because there's such transatlantic traffic now. At one point, I think they weren't sure they were going to bring Network, but it certainly seemed the obvious place to bring it back to Broadway. I don't love the production as a whole. There's a lot I really enjoy about it. It's Eva Van Hove, who is master of immersive theater and sort of tearing things down and then reconstructing them in interesting ways. And the way they use cameras in it is incredible. the script for me isn't, I know everyone says it was the great prophecy of, you know, how the way entertainment would take over America, the way, I mean, not television anymore, but obviously screens would dominate the way we look at our lives. And physically, that production, I thought, did that very interestingly. Paddy Chayefsky's script sounds a little stale to me in some places now. But Cranston, Bryan Cranston, my gosh, what an amazing performance. And this is someone who is obviously, he's been on stage before, most notably as Lyndon Johnson in All the Way, for which he won a Tony Award. But he's also spent most of his time in recent years on television. And the way he would use cameras on stage, because a lot of it is simulcast, and to see him playing with the camera and portraying a man who has always defined himself really as existing only on camera, I mean, that's major. It's a great, great performance, I think.
It's amazing. I found that performance just to be stunning. And gripping, but you're right. Then there's the story, which, for benefit of listeners who have not seen it, would have been the Faye Dunaway, William Holden characters, and their love triangle that just seems odd and out of place, and ultimately what is being said.
Yeah, it seems stale. I mean, it's much more sort of the classic midlife crisis story, white middle-aged American man goes, wait a minute, my life is half over and I haven't done this, and which has been the subject of so many novels and so many movies, and particularly around the time Network was made in the 1970s. Tony Goldwyn is an actor I like, but I didn't think he could really do a lot to bring this particular existential crisis to life. And Tatiana Maslany, who is brilliant on Orphan Black, the television series, is in the Faye Dunaway part. And I think they were trying for something different, making that character who is described as television incarnate, this soulless woman who is really only known life in two dimensions. That's the only way she can think of it. They made her into a much more sort of a kind of generic Eager Beaver employee, whereas Faye Dunaway, I mean, no matter what you think of her and anything else, that is a brilliant performance. It is so mannered, it is so artificial, it is so stylized, and connects so interestingly to that character.
Let's talk about some other performances that I just found to be outstanding. Glenda Jackson in Three Tall Women. Edward Albee, what an amazing production!
Yeah.
What an amazing performance!
That was a gorgeous production, directed by Joe Mantello. I'd reviewed the original Three Tall Women, which really sort of heralded Edward Albee's comeback in New York. He's someone else who had fallen out of fashion and been effectively ostracized, and this was the play. It won the Pulitzer. That announced he was very much alive and still had an incredibly fertile imagination and sense of craft. I had the great fortune to interview Glenda Jackson, to spend some time with her before this production opened in New York. And she had done King Lear in London at that point, at the age of 79. And this was the first time she had set foot in a theater in more than 20 years, because she'd been a parliamentarian. She'd been a member of parliament. And of course, when I was a kid, I thought she was the coolest thing around in movies like Sunday Bloody Sunday, Women in Love. I mean, she was so unlike any Hollywood movie star. Won two Oscars, had this amazing career, and then suddenly she was gone. I mean, as far as the world was concerned, not as far as England was concerned, obviously, but she told me she did not actually even go to the theater for the entire time she was in Parliament. She made some memorable speeches there, including a brilliant denunciation of Margaret Thatcher that you can watch on YouTube after Mrs. Thatcher died and everyone else was you know, singing their pious hosannas. She was 81, I think, when she did Three Tall Women. And you're thinking, you're coming back to Broadway at that age? First of all, can you remember it all? I mean, can you project the way you have to? You know, this is a woman who smokes at least 20 cigarettes a day. I mean, she's not lived hard. I think she takes pretty good care of herself otherwise. But, you know, she wasn't going to the gym every day the way so many performers are. And boy, just from the second you see her on stage, she's playing one of three versions of the same woman, who's basically Edward Albee's mother, a geriatric woman whose mind is starting to slip, but her will and the force of life in her, which is not necessarily a pleasant force, is still very, very much there. And you had Laurie Metcalf on the stage, who another really fine actress playing the same woman at a different age. But really, all you wanted to watch was Glinda Jackson. It was just one of those rare instances where the presence seemed to practically explode the stage. And she is coming back, I'm happy to say, early next year, as King Lear, the part she did in London under Deborah Warner's direction. This will have a different director, Sam Gold, who did a terrific Othello, and also a great Hamlet with Oscar Isaac. So he rethinks Shakespeare, again, without destroying what's great to begin with, the essence of it.
Looking at a geriatric theme on Broadway, also, of course, we got to see Elaine May, who is still in the Waverly Gallery, which is stunning to see her.
Oh, wasn't that the most exciting thing? I mean, Elaine May, I grew up and my parents were great fans of Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And she's one of those sort of, you know, will-o'-the-wisp legends. You know, now you see her, now you don't. Everyone thinks she's sort of the greatest thing going, and as a director, as a script doctor, but her career has been erratic in terms of how much she's actually been there. And this is the first time she's set foot on a Broadway stage since the early 1960s. And she's playing a woman with dementia. It's a memory play by the great playwright Kenneth Lonergan, who had two very fine plays on Broadway this season, and the other called Lobby Hero. She's playing a woman whose memory is slipping, but because of the way it's written, it's very specifically cadenced. So you'd think, okay, I'm, you know, an old woman's going to play an old woman. How hard can that be? But what she had to memorize and the way she had to deliver it and just how moving it is, how funny and how absolutely tragic. No, that was definitely a high point for me.
And I thought Lucas Hedges was beautiful.
Lucas Hedges is fabulous. He plays the narrator. He basically plays the author, Kenneth Lonergan, who occasionally steps forward to address the audience and sort of provide a little retrospective distance on what was a very confusing time, as it is when you're with someone who's essentially losing their mind.
Ben Brantley is our guest. We are talking about the Best of Broadway 2018. We should mention, we have not mentioned yet, which is one of the biggest shows that will probably be on Broadway for many, many years to come, and that is Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Yeah.
And here again, you're in the theater for a very long time, and it's all enjoyable.
It doesn't seem... I mean, did you do both parts
yes.
in one day? Yeah, I did too, which is how I done it in London as well. And of course, in London, we really didn't know what we were going to get at that
right.
point. This was... it was the opening that I went to, and it seemed like... well, obviously, it was pre-sold to a certain extent. I mean, talk about having brand name value. Harry Potter, how can you go wrong? This was a new story idea by J.K. Rowling. And it spreads over close to 6 hours. And really, it really is a full day's commitment if you're going to do it all in one day. But it was just so beautifully, it was just as a work of theater. I mean, the magic in it, without seeming like magic acts, it seemed instead like a universe where these things would happen. And there were moments like when Harry Potter's son and his best friend, one best friend and a young woman who was accompanying them, become effectively their parents. They turn into the adults before our eyes to sneak into a ministry through certain magical spells that I will not try to be specific about because I'm sure I would be pilloried by the Harry Potter fans. But that all the way through, it was just... Actually, I'm not going to deliver any spoilers, but it has a twist in the plot. Again, seeing it the second time and knowing what was coming, I could see how carefully it was prepared for. But it's very well set up. John Tiffany directed it, and Stephen Hoggett, his frequent collaborator, did the movement, which in itself, I mean, there were just moments when, like, they twirl their capes, the ensemble, and the stage would change. It was beautiful. It wasn't the kind of, high tech, although I'm sure there's a lot of high tech, you know, behind the scenes, but it never felt like artificial spectacle. It felt like a genuinely magical world.
It had a stripped down quality to it.
It did, exactly. Which is John Tiffany had done, I don't know if you saw The Glass Menagerie with Terry Jones a few years ago, but that was his also, and Stephen
Zachary
Hoggett.
Quinto, yeah.
And Zachary Quinto. And also a great stage production that never made it to Broadway, an adaptation of Let the Right One In, the Scandinavian vampire movie that was, and he has a very specific visual signature, which is you keep it simple, at least ostensibly, but then within that simplicity, it's like the proverbial rabbit out of the hat, an austere hat, like a Quaker hat. The things that that you see happen before you. Yeah, Harry Potter, I mean, the scenery is basically just staircases. I mean, they've redone the entire theater to suggest sort of that you're going to Hogwarts Academy. But in that, I mean, in what better play to let the magic of the stage take over without, you know, real opulence or embellishment.
And let us remember that Jack Thorne, who wrote the script, also wrote King Kong.
Yes, yes, I know. I think that's kind of reassuring, don't you?
Before we move away from plays totally, I have to say the one play that I wanted to like that I didn't, and I believe you did, although I think I'm right on that, was Travesties.
Oh, love Travesties. That was something else I'd seen in London. That's Tom Stoppard's play about a moment in history that actually was more or less true, in which Tristan Tzara, the Dadaist poet, James Joyce, the author of Ulysses, and Karl Marx were all in, what is the town? It wasn't Vienna. It was Prague.
Prague, same moment
in history. Sorry. This is told as the reminiscences of a man who with the British embassy named Henry Carr. And the story keeps changing because memory is fallible. But what was so brilliant about it is that Stoppard uses the talents and perspectives of these three great men who really revolutionized thinking in the 20th century to become the form of the play. But because it's being told by more or less by this man, Henry Carr, who can't quite wrap his mind around all of it, it keeps changing form. And in addition to that, we have the mind or the sensibility of Oscar Wilde permeating it all, because for reasons that I cannot begin to explain to you right now without taking up the rest of your time, there's a production of The Importance of Being Earnest going on as well.
It is, and we should say, though, that there were individual performances in that were just, to me, outstanding.
You mean Tom Holland?
Yes.
Yeah, who is playing Carr. He was wonderful. And he has to be all these different ages within a matter of seconds. I mean, and again, without, you know, putting on the gray wig or whatever, just a kind of, you know, a droop of the eyelid and a slump of the shoulder, he's suddenly the old man again. And then he steps right back into the past.
What happened to the musical this year?
Musicals this year, I can't even remember. What won? I mean, The Band's Visit, which I'd seen off-Broadway before, I thought transferred beautifully. But that wasn't this year.
That was last year.
That was the year before. We had several, actually, musicals that we thought might not play too well to contemporary audiences because of being slightly out of date in terms of sexual politics. We had Carousel, which, of course, has the, if you know the show, has the notorious moment where the heroine is asked by her daughter if a hit can feel like a kiss. And you go, wait a minute. And that is a hit by a man. They kind of hedged on that in this production directed by Jack O'Brien. And My Fair Lady, in which based on the Pygmalion story, the George Bernard Shaw version of the Pygmalion story, then translated into a great musical in which a woman is sort of shaped in the image of a professor of phonetics, Henry Higgins, Eliza Doolittle and Henry Higgins. And the director, in this case, Bartlett Schur, I think tried to inject a much stronger sort of feminist subtext to it that I'm not sure was entirely necessary. I think you know that Eliza holds her own by the end. But it was sort of fascinating to see what was done with that. The show that won the Tony for Best Musical Revival, Once on This Island, I thought was delightful.
Beautiful.
Did you saw that? Yeah.
A beautiful production.
Yeah. Just charming and full of life. And although I have friends, feminist friends, who object to the story of that too, because a woman sacrifices herself for a no good man. But hey, that still happens in life sometimes.
It'll be, I assume, coming Tony time, it'll be difficult to come up with a full list of best revivals.
Well, we have Oklahoma transferring to Broadway, don't forget.
Which, thank goodness.
Yes.
Now, I did not see it in its latest production. I did see the Bard production.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. It's Daniel Fish. It's just, he reconceives it, again, without betraying the essence of it. It's a very stripped-down production of this famous Rodgers and Hammerstein musical about farmers and cowhands. And it's, what, a 5 or 6-piece band. Again, minimal staging. It's set up sort of like a town hall. The audience gets to eat chili and cornbread at the intermission, and it is sounds like a really kind of jolly all-American gathering, doesn't it? And it turns out to be so dark in ways, again, that I think were always in the musical that it brings to the surface about American notions of when violence is appropriate and ownership and sex.
Oklahoma is coming to Broadway in 2019. So as we end, what are you looking forward to in the coming year?
Well, I'm especially looking forward to Glenda Jackson in King Lear. That's one of the greatest third acts in show business history. And I'm really looking forward to seeing Oklahoma reincarnated. I don't think it'll be that different. I think it's going to circle in the square,
yes,
which means it'll allow it to sort of retain that kind of intimate, stripped-down flavor. That's the theater, not theater in the round, but a theater in the rectangle sort of house, smaller house by Broadway standards. No, there's a lot to look forward to. And I still haven't seen To Kill a Mockingbird, which my colleague Jesse reviewed, and I'm certainly looking forward to that. So it's been a fairly abundant year, all things considered. And
the other thing coming to Broadway this year, which I did see in Boston, is, which I find
exciting,
Moulin
Rouge.
Moulin Rouge.
I loved Moulin Rouge, yeah. That, again, I hadn't, who knew? I mean, it's the ultimate jukebox musical in that it seems to take, you know, records from as long as there have been records, basically scramble them all together, as anyone knows who saw the movie. And it does so even more now with more recent tunes integrated into it. But I thought Alex Timber, the director, did a great job of finding kind of a soul within that. This is not just, you know, listening to pop hits coming at you. There's a real, it's sort of the way that we always attach pop hits to very emotional moments in our lives without even thinking about it. And I think that's what that production is trafficking in and does so well. So yes, I can't wait to see that again.
Well, beautiful stuff coming and beautiful stuff still on Broadway. Ben Brantley has been the co-chief theater critic of the New York Times. You can read his work at newyorktimes.com. Follow links to the shows discussed at our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Ben, happy new year to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Happy theater going.
What a great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.